This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, on ethics and politics. If knowledge is not mingled with spiritual purification and the training of ethics, the owner of knowledge will cause more harm to the people than a person who has no knowledge. This person may use his or her knowledge as a sword to cut off the roots of a country. June 28, 1979.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today we have another saying of the Imam Khomeini in which he has said, in regards to the prophets of God, he said that the prophets came to call people out of darkness into light. In the last episode, we referred to a verse in which we said, Allah is the guardian of all the believers and he brings out the mu'mineen from darkness to the light. Now, how he does that? He does it through the prophetic mission, as we mentioned in the last episode. Here, Imam Khomeini is saying, like, the prophets came to call people out of darkness into light. There are two groups. One are the prophets of the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of the God, who are sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who are the army of God, and they call us towards the light. There is another group, which is taghut in the Quran, which is known as the rebels. And Allah says, Allahu waliyul ladina amanu yukhrijuhum min adh-dhulumati ila an-nur. Allah is the guardian of the believers, and he takes them out of the darkness towards the nur. He takes them from darkness and he brings them into the light. وَالَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا. But those who disbelieve in Allah, who disbelieve in God, who disbelieve in his prophets, who disbelieve in the teachings of the prophets, أَوْلِيَاؤُهُمْ الطَّاغُوتُ. Their guardians are rebels. يُخْرِجُونَهُمْ مِنَ النُّورِ إِلَى الظُّلُمَةِ. They take them out of nur, out of light, and they take them towards the darkness. They take them towards the darkness. And for them, Allah said, whoever disbelieves, if taghut, if rebel becomes their guardian, then they're going towards the darkness. And this darkness will lead them towards the hellfire, where they will live forever. The prophets, it was the duty of the prophet, it is the duty of prophet, to take people out of darkness and to take them into the light. And that's what the prophets were doing. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. Quran, or the books that we have, obviously the Quran is the mean of guidance. This book is the book of guidance. This book is not just a book to tell what happened in the past with the other prophets. No, this book is the guidance for the God very ones. And we need to take that guidance out of this book. Why? Because this book is the light. This book is not enough for us. We need to follow the teachings and the narrations of the Prophet as well. Because book itself is not enough. Allah has sent a teacher with it, which was the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And the Prophet has basically taught us how to follow this book. He taught us that this book is light. In his narrations, there are the explanations of the things that are said in this book. So we need to follow this book, inshallah. If we want to come out of the darkness and go into the light, we need to follow the prophets, because that was the duty of the prophets. May Allah give us tawfiq to, inshallah, follow the teachings of the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, so that we come out of the darkness and go into the light, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Every night and every day. in the limelight.
Data show that rural residents across the U.S. are less likely to receive a flu shot than residents of the metropolitan areas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Elizabeth Miller, researcher. This article is published under the heading, Rural U.S. is seriously short on resources needed to distribute vaccine. Stay tuned for the details, please. As the United States begins its massive vaccine rollout, health departments across the country are scrambling to plan and adjust, often while simultaneously managing a surge in new COVID-19 cases. Additionally, data showed that rural residents are less likely to receive a flu shot than residents of metropolitan areas. This trend, combined with the reluctance of rural communities to embrace coronavirus mitigation measures, as some experts worried. Think about a person who needs to drive 1 hour for a shot, then do the same 20 days later for a second shot, said Diego Cuadras, a professor of health, geography, and disease modeling at the University of Cincinnati. If it's a person who maybe doesn't think this is too important or has some mispreparation or misinformation about vaccines, this is going to be extremely challenging. Ultimately, Cuadras and others worry that the virus might linger in pockets of rural America, from which it could re-emerge into the broader population, compromising efforts to get the virus under control. To prevent this, healthcare workers are starting with a public information campaign, while state health departments are encouraging pharmacies to run outreach clinics and set up new sites for vaccinations. Currently, the most pressing issue facing less populated areas is how to store and administer vaccines before they lose their effectiveness. The messenger RNA technology used to develop the two vaccines that have received approval in the U.S. so far requires that they both be kept cold. Purchasing super cold storage equipment is costly and demands a higher voltage outlet, said Eric Tichy, Vice Chair of Supply Chain Management for the Mayo Clinic. Stock of that equipment, particularly of the size that would be appropriate for the smaller pharmacies and clinics, is also simply sold out. That may leave many of them leaning on container and dry ice refills. With 237 vaccines in development on the World Health Organization's list of candidates, the future will likely include vaccines that tolerate warmer temperatures. The bigger challenge Tichy sees is that once a vaccine vial is opened, staff have just 6 hours to use all 5 or 10 doses it contains. It's a precious resource, he said. You don't want to just give it to 2 people and have to throw out the rest of the contents. You want to get 5 people vaccinated. The first wave of inoculations targets healthcare workers and residents in long-term care facilities, so there is a central location at which vaccines can reach them. For vaccinating the public at large, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has partnered with large national pharmacy chains as well as networks of small regional chains and independent pharmacies. The Rural Policy Research Institute at the University of Iowa found 750 counties nationwide with no partnership pharmacies, and another 334 with just one such pharmacy. The majority of states have at least one county without a partnership pharmacy. A large swathes of Kansas, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Texas, and smaller chunks of Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Utah reported no partnered pharmacies. In some states, that hasn't presented much of a hurdle. Independent pharmacies have procured doses of the vaccines and done well administering them, but rates vary widely from state to state. Rural communities often run short on resources, whether it's cold storage facilities or a population of retired nurses and doctors to tap to help administer vaccines, he added. The geography can also compound the disparities in access that affect racial minorities. Kim Atwater, who owns two pharmacies in rural New Mexico towns, decided that for now it doesn't make sense to order doses of the vaccines. "We don't have refrigeration facilities to keep it," she said. "We're just a very, very small community." In rural areas, the lack of pharmacies and major medical centers means that much of the vaccination effort is falling to local health clinics like the one in Mora. "We know it's a cardinal sin to waste a dose, and we are not trying to be wasteful. Unwillingness to get vaccinated may also present a hurdle," a doctor said. While some national surveys report growing numbers saying they will take a COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes available to them, Quattro said he hasn't seen that data broken down between rural and urban respondents. Data that tracked vaccination rates for influenza shows them much lower in rural areas. Atwater conversations with locals suggest that pattern may carry over to the new vaccines. "There is a lot of people who are just saying, 'Oh, I'm not getting that,'" she said. "We hear a lot of that. No, not until there is more testing done on it." Mora bucked trends this fall by making flu vaccination more convenient. Her clinic offered drive-through clinics, welcomed walk-ins, sent staff to patients' homes, and even invited a UPS driver to receive a shot after dropping off packages at the clinic. As a result, they administered 400 flu vaccines compared to roughly 250 last year. A poll showed only 29 of about 86 clinic staff were immediately interested in taking the vaccine.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. This is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protests police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Unconscious.
Well, cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV. In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on the street.
In riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, but protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight.
The
significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest. But it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
we did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at a given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage of the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African-American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African-American women have been playing a central role.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, critically about it, because regardless of what happens in the situation, they're not held accountable. which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah, absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop, like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered, right? right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we've seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I've never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide to operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now, the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnbeck, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
Just as much anger out here.
Police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, exclusively here on this radio channel, not on any other radio channel in the world. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, the world, and Iran in particular, the revolutionaries across the world, I have to say, were shocked by the assassination of Shahid Fakhrizadeh, the great scientist of Iran. But I'd just like to point out, this is not something new. They have been assassinating our scientists throughout the Muslim world, and particularly in Iran. We had the assassination of Dr. Majid Shahriari of Ahmadi Roshan as well before. So they've been targeting our talented individuals. Why is the question I'd like to throw at you today? And I think I'm going to Sheikh Ali first.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. See, the way it works is that those nations or those countries or those governments that do not want or wish for other governments and countries to develop and progress, they target their talents.
Mm-hmm.
How do the talents get targeted? They get targeted in multiple ways. One of them is brain drain, right? When you take the talented individuals and you offer them immigration, offer them good salary packages, you know, mm-hmm. these scholarships and so on and so forth, and pull them out of those countries, right? So all of the talented individuals from that particular country travel to another country where they live for the rest of their lives. Hence, this brain drain works, and we are seeing it in the Islamic world. The second way is when they can't see this strategy working, because there are some people who love their country, who love Islam, who love this region, who love living amongst the Muslims. They tend to and they like to stay in this region and these countries. What do? Well, they try to control them over here. How? By offering grants. You would be surprised, even in Iran, the University of Tehran, you know, the professors, they, in many cases, they get grants from the United States to do their research. Well, hang on. We thought like you were at odds with each other. What's mm-hmm. going on here, right? Mm-hmm. How are these grants even making it to you, right? How are these indirect channels working? I don't want to get into details, but mm-hmm. it is a reality. This is how they control these, you know, brilliant minds sitting in Iran.
Right.
Then those who don't even, you know, entered this arena and they're not really catered to and controlled through this channel of bribing in the name of research and grants, what do? They kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where people like Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he comes, Shahid Roshan. These are those people who were loyal not just to Iran, but to Islam, but to the real scientific development, but to be independent of the bullying and arrogance of the U.S., Israel, and U.K., and France. They wanted to build that great Iran and the great Islamic civilization. So now they're out of control. You can already see they get targeted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just very quickly, this whole idea of targeting the talented individuals It is such a pathetic and low idea that you have no clue, right? So you can't compete that person. Mm-hmm. You can't buy that person. You can't bribe that person. You can't just threaten and control that person. What do? Go around and kill that person. This is so cowardly. And that too in scientific arena.
Yeah.
And by the way, it is not only science. Yes, today it is science because Iran is developing at a speed, at a pace that is 11 times faster than the rest of the world, according to Forbes. And the leader has mentioned it in the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, the manifesto that he wrote, right? So Iran is developing at an 11 times faster speed. Today the fight is about science and technology. But you go 40 years ago, what happened? The fight was about ideology, right? So what did they do? They martyred people like Shahid Murtaza Mutahri. He was not a scientist. He was an academic. They martyred people like Shahid Beheshti. He was not a fighter. He was not a scientist. He was not anything else but a religious scholar. Why would they target them? So this is where the enemy is good, right? The enemy knows that what the battlefield is today.
Yes.
If it is science and technology, they go target scientists. If it is just, you know, plain old ideology where your scholars are coming to the forefront and challenging Marxism, communism, capitalism, imperialism, all of these things, they go after them.
Yes.
So this is where the battle is today, scientific development. And this is why the leader has emphasized so much on it in recent time. He's leading from the front.
This beautifully put. Say, Mehdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, there's not too much, again, like I said, that I can add here. One of the points that did come to my mind, which echoes what he had said, was this idea of competition. So a brave and courageous person, a brave and courageous people would compete on this scientific field, you know, like the Olympics. Right, so in the Olympics, you have people from all over the world come, and you know, and they compete with each other fairly, bravely. We choose the best amongst us to compete with each other. It's almost like, you know, well, I know that this runner from, you know, let's say Zimbabwe, he's a good runner. He might win. So let's just kill him before the competition. Man, what kind of a world is that? And this is what's being done, right? And the assassination and the murder of innocent civilians, because mind you, these are not military guys, these aren't generals, or, you know, they're civilians, they are innocent scientists, right? Working for the development of their country, and to assassinate and murder these innocent people who are not on the battlefield, right? Is a cowardly act, a criminal act. And it's a desperate move. A terrorist act and a desperate move. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so because you cannot compete with these people on that level, you can't become better than they are, so let's just start killing them off.
And the fascinating thing about these people is that they were all educated inside Iran.
Right.
You know, they are homegrown people.
Right. It's homegrown knowledge, right? Yes. That's the beauty of it. And we see that.
You're saying that they weren't criminals, but they did have a crime, right? Their crime was being faithful to their country and religion.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which has been branded as a crime.
In the eyes of the opposition, this is their crime, right? Mm-hmm. In our eyes, that's their honor.
Exactly.
You know? But this act of killing these scientists, innocent scientists, right, shows the enmity against the people of Iran, an enmity against the progress of the people, and an enmity against the advancement of the people of Iran. Just as a closing segment, you know, this idea that the enemy knows what battlefield they need to target, which is one of the things that Sheikh Ali was talking about. It's interesting, and it was 100% right. In the beginning, when the ideology was a threat, you killed all of the major ideologues of the Islamic Revolution. When science has become an issue for them, so they start to kill the nuclear scientists. One connection that I made after this was Haj Qasim and Abu Mehdi. So when the resistance to free Palestine was becoming so real and serious for them, they end up killing these two great and honorable martyrs.
I just wanted to add to that, because you said that they are enemies of Iran and Iranian people. I want to add to that. They are enemies to anyone who is developing independently.
Right.
Because if any country in the world independent of America and the other Tawarit that exist, if they started to develop, rest assured their scientists would get killed as well.
Right.
They don't want anybody to progress while it's not under their nose and under their control. Yeah, control is the right word. So they're trying to say that that Iran is building a nuclear bomb. What are your thoughts on that?
So, see, when it comes to the nuclear issue, right, and it is not a recent phenomena. For decades now, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, he has made it blatantly clear that his fatwa, his official Islamic verdict on the issue is that Islam does not allow anyone, not just Iranians, anyone to build and make nuclear bombs. Okay, so this is very clear. And when Imam Khamenei says something, not just because of his respect and love and affection that people have and the officials have towards him, but in addition to that, because of the position he has in the Islamic Republic and the system, nobody can go against him. Nobody can dare go against him in the sense that he issues a fatwa which is at the system level that the system is not allowed to do, and then they still go out and, you know, start building that thing. It is not an option because of the way the structure is, right? Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be that chief in command, right?
Yes.
So he has given not only a ruling at the level of the system, but also the Islamic ruling, right? Mm-hmm. Which makes it haram and forbidden for anyone to develop nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so what's the fuss about? These clips, these videos have been out for decades now. And he has not just said it once. It is multiple times that he has mentioned it. So many times, you know, if you just go in and search it online, you will find it very easily. Now, why are they making a big deal out of it then? Well, this is how the United States of America operates. They're all about propaganda. If they want to target someone, they create this motive and they create this excuse to justify their targeting of that individual or that system or that country or that region, right? For instance, this war on terror. Well, how can you ignore that there are billions of Muslims living in this part of the world, and then you say that, oh, because of the war on terror, we have a license to just walk in and take our army boots in there, and this whole fancy big old weaponry in this region and tanks, and we're just going to uproot terrorism. What gave them this license? Well, they made people afraid. They created that excuse, right? And what did they do? The whole world saw. Like, all they did is they spread terrorism in this in this world, especially in this region, and their own presence. America's own presence in this region is terrorism, not a source of terrorism. It is terrorism. Right? America being here, American troops being here, American soldiers being here, it is terrorism. So, back to my point, they create an excuse to go and do their dirty work and evil work. Now, when it comes to nukes and nuclear energy, one thing we have to be very clear of, and that is, nuclear energy is the right of every sovereign nation that exists on the planet. Why? Because the nations need to keep going. They need to have an operating system, right? In order for their system to keep operating, nuclear energy is that source.
And I'm nuclear talking about energy, I just want to point this out, is a very good thing. It's almost like, you know, free energy. It's very helpful
exactly.
for the development
and this
of
is what the future is. And what the United States of America wants to do against Iran is to cripple it from its future. Why? Because they want that dependency.
Mm-hmm.
Yet again, right? The dependency of Iranian nation, they want to take away their independence from them. This is why they don't want Iranians to build nuclear energy, right? Let us talk about the nuclear weapons, right? Mm-hmm. Who possesses nuclear weapons in the world today? And who has used these nuclear weapons in the world today, these atomic bombs in the world today?
The great Satan,
so where,
America.
Where is the voice against that? Mm. Why are we not creating a fuss about that? Why are we not talking about disarming the United States of America, the great Satan, the evil entity that has created chaos on this planet? Disarm it. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to talk about it. Why? Because America strong arms everyone. Then Israel, has it signed the NPT? First of all, Israel is not a legitimate country. So it doesn't really come in that whole sequence, right?
Mm.
But has it signed NPT?
No.
Well, so why is the fuss not about Israel? See, this is how they isolate the Islamic Republic. On purpose, they know Iran gave access to the IAEA, full access to their nuclear facilities.
Yeah.
The inspectors came. They had nothing on Iran. And they wrote their reports. The United Nations was satisfied till America comes in, starts intervening again, and strong-arming and isolating Iran again.
That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed the show. From myself, from Sayyid Mehdi, from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars, the moon. I join them all in praising you. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I feel alive and I feel so good. I feel so close, so close.
IRIB English Radio.